Holy shit, Lenny, that was so good. You really weren't lying. These seats behind the stage aren't half bad.
I mean, it's the Garden, it's New Year's Eve, and you get the same view as Trey the whole show. Unless you're one of those weirdos who has to see the stage at all times, and I'm here to dance. I've seen a bunch of late 50-year-old some white dudes stand on stage and look fucking goofy at each other. But I do miss Trey's smiles and Paige's eyebrows lifting when he's really fucking getting into it. But I get all the fishermen I want, and to be honest, he's the one who'd be most likely to hang out with me and put up with all my political fucking rhetoric and bullshit.
Oh, that's definitely true. I will admit, though, when you showed me these tickets, I was pissed off. I was like, this dude said he would cover night one of the run, and we would hang out while my partner is over in these fat-ass club box seats?
Yeah, I had one of those a while back, but I can never find 5 to 10 solid people who got a couple grand to drop on New Year's Eve. I mean, all my friends are organizers, artists, and weird queer pastors, and queer faith leaders, and other queer fuckers, and, you know, we just all broke.
I get it. But goddamn, that set. What was that weird-ass new song they played at the end? What was that? I haven't heard it before, and why is Tab's horn section here? I mean, this was so good.
I don't know. I'm going to try and find out. The staff hooked me up to the Wi-Fi a few years ago before the pandemic started, and they haven't changed it, so I can check fish from the road, but it'll take a minute.
All right, go ahead. I'm going to head over to section 119, because that's where Drew's meeting me.
119? Hell fucking yeah. Will you get me a spicy chicken sandwich, please?
You have the fucking concession stands memorized?
Well, it's actually a funny story that starts with a Trey reference and ends with a new place to get your suit tailored. Truly a New York City dream story. Or it could just be my ADHD. One is left with several variations when watching
Lenny, you seem high as fuck when you've been dancing this long, so I'm gonna be right back. Chill out.
Just ask him. Go ahead, look at him. Go ask.
No, you ask him.
I asked the two guys on the train and the guy out front.
All right. Hey, bro. Hey, man. What's up?
Huh? Me? What's up, man?
Yeah. Can you come over here?
What's up, man? Making me move my weary ass bones.
Oh, my bad. You were here the whole time?
Yeah, so have you and I assume your partner, right? Because you guys have already broken the fucking cardinal rule like 3 times. You've done like 4 passes to the beer in the bathroom line.
Oh, is that how it is that shows you with him?
What?
No. Don't listen to him. He's such a party pooper. Hi, I'm Lori, and we're visiting from Chicago. We're used to a little bit more access to party favors. Maybe go skiing while we're out here. But you seem like a man who can help us.
Oh, we just assuming genders now. Anyway.
Here, bro, just hit this and mellow. It's a mellow scene. You know, this is like my 4th New Year's run. And I have to tell you, you don't have to be so uptight. I mean, like, this time here, set break, get to know people, smoke together, you know, do some trades, some deals, you know. And if you like, we have to go to our neighborhood after the show. That's cool. And my lady, you know, she's down.
Yeah, baby, I mean, as long as we could spend the whole night riding a nice rail. I mean, you are cute. It wouldn't be my first time.
And we are paying.
So why don't you tell your friend you'll see her later when she gets back?
And then I can tell you all about this band. I mean, if you want to learn, I brought my friend Kareem, our old New York City friend from our first visit. And he wasn't into it, just the white girls and the money, right? But if you open your mind a little, I'm sure we can all have a good time.
Sir, do you think I am a native New Yorker who has wandered into Madison Square Garden the day before New Year's Eve, completely unaware who Fish is? The history of this run, or that I have ever heard of this band, who will now take you to a black and brown neighborhood, sell you cocaine, then cuckold the fuck out of you in front of your partner all night long before New Year's Eve.
Hopefully.
Jesus Christ, Lenny, I can't leave you alone for 3 seconds. What fuckery is this?
Oh, these nice folks just want the special tour of Brooklyn. But I'm about to give them the good news.
Fam, what are you talking about?
Y'all, we can do all that and more. I'm super into it. Thank you so much for stopping me. But why not get this party started right now? How much y'all looking for?
I knew it. I told you, baby. This guy was my G.
What in the actual fuck is your weird ass doing with our evening, Lenny? Are you hearing this guy?
Okay, so maybe like an 8-ball, and I'll come back after set to hang with you, sweetie.
Yes.
Word, 300. All right, Leslie, let's get the fuck out of here.
Okay, that's it. We talked about it when you pulled that Kool-Aid prank during fall tour. You've lost your fucking mind in 1 year on tour, haven't you? You selling drugs to loud-ass white people? I'm starting to get worried about you. I'm going to call Jason over at PRX and Jay at Ben & Jerry's, and we're going to have some sort of an intervention or some shit, because we wanted you to get a sense of tour for the season, and here we are a year later, and you've gone full fucking Wookiee. And I'm so sorry this happened to you. Come here.
No, Leslie, see, my dear elder in the community who looks 10 years younger than me, but acts lifetimes wiser. What are you talking about? I gave those kids a bag with glitter, white powder, the chemicals the homies use around the way to make your teeth numb at first, 2 GA tickets to tomorrow night's show, a card from the podcast with my Venmo to request their money back, an explanation in the letter with the tickets, and some other goofball saw me dancing and thought I was on drugs and gave me 2 hits of fluff, and I quote, "for the fuel we use here, bro," which I didn't even know how to fucking take. Anyway, I just put that in there too. I mean, I know the kid who gave it to me, so I know they're good, but he just didn't even recognize me. I just think it's all that trickster energy I got going on in these parts.
If this was all a prank, Lenny, that was a lot of thought you put in. I'm kind of sad, but how many times has this happened to you on the New Year's run that you have this in-depth of a prank just ready to go in your pocket?
I mean, a lot, Leslie. Can we change the subject? I mean, we've talked about this a lot. You know, if we could just go down here, I know a back stairs we can get to. It's my friend's Craig's suite is right at the bottom, and he's visiting from the Virgin Islands, and he always does it right.
I just need to know what was in this letter that you gave to them.
Okay, I have another copy in my note on my phone. I'll read it to you. Dear fan, and hopefully someday family, what a year it's been, right? I mean, you may or may not have allowed fascism to rise and swallow the last vestiges of democracy, or even actively participated in it. Hey, it's a crazy world, and I'm often wrong. We all had our masks on. Maybe you were on the front lines with me on the side of the angels and mothers. But whoever you are, I want to tell you the first message I ever truly received on tour. The one that hit me in my heart. Which I hope by now, seeing this letter and these tickets, you too can receive. It is simple old words from a better world. I love you. And sometimes love reveals the ugly parts of us all. There is no cocaine in here. Just a few tickets, whatever other extracurriculars the other maniacs in our family gave me tonight. I've been around just long enough that I don't really need that stuff anymore. I remember being in a place where I realized I wouldn't know love, family, or wisdom if it was staring me in the face. I remember when I was so numb to the pain in the world that I just went about my life unable to hear the deep cries and wounds of those about me in the moments and places where it counted the most. I spent most of my 28 years in the greater jam band scene making a complete and utter ass of myself, and I have a very checkered past and record. I haven't always been accountable to the call to just be a channel for love in this scene. To learn, even though I, with all my heartfelt beliefs, my burning rage at the system, participate in a cycle that makes it so hard for people like us to even connect here in this place. I have and may still miss the whole point of the thing, to be completely honest with you. It actually saved my soul to learn how terribly wrong I had been, not just about the people in this scene, but the inherent beauty in the world they had been pointing to the whole time. My point is, you were wrong about me. And someone was kind enough after the years of me doing the exact same thing you're doing in this run to show me that I was actually stepping on the beauty and blocking the growth of real people who were impacted by me, and the community in this sacred place. And I was doing that knowingly. In the end, it was my own intellectual or spiritual laziness that kept me from seeing things for how they really are. I do you the same kindness. I'm not sure what else ended up in the bag, but I'm sure it's family, and it's going to feed your head. You can do coke tomorrow. Together, we still have a chance to see a better world.
that is drifting within reach. Written in Love and Liberation, Lenny Duncan.
P.S. Check out our podcast, bro.
Man, those white people aren't going to read that letter. You're so fucking weird.
I don't know. I'm bored. I just beat a $10 ATM fee and I could pick up a not gross couple and be their fucking unicorn in Craig's suite a little bit later. And it's New York City, baby. If I can make it here, I can make it anywhere. Welcome to Blackberry Jam, supported by Ben and Jerry's, where I, Lenny Duncan,
and I, Leslie Mack,
pull back the curtain on how jam band culture and black liberation work intersect.
Each episode, we explore stories of black fans and envision a jam band community with liberation, love, and fish tickets by mail for all.
And welcome to episode 8. Please stop asking me if I sell coke at Madison Square Garden. And I just want to say that if Wook Plus doesn't give us a Wookiee Award, Leslie, for best dramatic fish scenes, I mean, in a podcast after all this, I mean, well, there's just no justice in this rotten world is all I'm saying. So, you know, if you listen to this podcast and you have Twitter, you should A, follow Wook Plus, B, harass the shit out of them on our behalf and make sure we get a Wookiee this year coming up. But Leslie, that whole opening skit, even though we put some humor in it and a little Hallmark moment for the white folks where they all woke up and read this magic letter, which you kind of made fun of at the end, that whole scene is basically the way I wish I had reacted in moments like that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, the dream way. I had the line. I had the thing I wanted to say. Yeah.
Yeah, I could have done that, you know? And so, like, it was fun to act that out for a second, right? That was some fantasy Black People League shit. You know what I mean? Like, I just scored, like, a ton of points, and that's real fun. But I wanted to spend some time with the listeners, not just reflecting on our little scene, but asking you the larger societal effects of the stereotypes of Black people, the classification of the Black male as a dangerous creature, the Black woman as either powerless or just angry, that has led to the Holocaust of our Black trans siblings and sisters, and a Black queer movement largely still a scandal internally and externally as Lil Nas X, that angelic queer currently rocking the whole world a la Prince and can come fucking hang out with me.
Call me by your name.
Come learn something from an older dad. Anyway, but like, you know, like after a little of that, of what we just saw demonstrated, you know, and after we had a little bit to take a break and get our shit together, I want to get into tour and do a summer tour wrap up and the show of the tour, in our opinion, fall tour, if that even happens. We don't know as of taping. We'll talk about that. How are you feeling about fall tour, Leslie?
The over under is not good. I'll say that, but we'll get into that a little later.
Yo, you're like a week away from flying out to do a show if we finally this season. This is like the saddest development. Anyway. And then our Halloween costume predictions for Fish, again, if it happens. But first, Leslie, a whole lot of me talking. I had to show up in one episode as the stereotypical Black male. So there we go. Whole lot of me up front. Can we just hear from you, though? We just briefly touched on a lot of stuff. And I always think the work starts person to person, heart to heart. I know sometimes we've had disagreements about this. But since I get to ask the questions this segment, I just want to know, Leslie, I mean, honestly, can you tell our listeners, would you mind sharing as much as you're willing to share, the first time you remember being stereotyped as a Black woman?
I don't mind sharing. I've told this story a few times, but I don't think as publicly as this. And I wasn't a Black woman yet. I was still a very young Black child, and it was actually in kindergarten. So listeners may remember that my family's from Jamaica, and part of our culture is that when you're younger, before you start school, you go back home and you spend some time just kind of living with your grandparents or aunts and uncles for a while. And so I did that from age 3 to 4. before coming back to the States to begin to go to school. Of course, while I was in Jamaica, I went to school. And me being me, I learned how to read, I learned how to write. And so when I got to kindergarten, I was, shall we say, a little more advanced than my peers. And so the first week of kindergarten comes, I'm very happy in my class and everything's going well. And it becomes very evident to my teacher that I can both read and write, and I know my address, and I know the names of all of my family members, and I know my phone number.
This is a reason to celebrate. I mean, look at this shining young star in the class.
Yeah, except for I was a little black girl with a slight Jamaican accent at that time. And all of a sudden, I was pulled out of class and brought to the principal's office, where they called my mother and asked her to come down to the school. The rest of this story will come from my mother's side of the conversation, but it went a little something like this. They asked my mother to produce my birth certificate because there's no way that I could actually be just 5 years old, because did my mother know that I could read and that I could write my name and that I knew all the things that I just mentioned?
Wait. I'm sorry, but I just have to ask. Are they asking your mother if she knows how old you are, literally, like she just doesn't know? Or are they accusing her of being a liar?
They're accusing us both of lying about my age, meaning I'm older than I am, and have put me into a younger class. I don't know for what purpose that would serve, but that was the accusation. That we had lied about my age and that I was not actually 5 years old, because there's no way that a five-year-old little black girl could know the things that I know.
Wow.
My mom went clean off. I remember lots of screaming. It ended with her telling them to never call her ever again for something this ridiculous. Of course, she knows all the things my child knows because I'm brilliant. And they should realize that and probably be really thankful that I'm in their school. So that was the first moment of being stereotyped as a black person, as a black child. I had many moments like that in my upbringing, or certainly in school in particular, where, you know, I was asking too many questions or too inquisitive or things like that. But that one I remember really specifically because I was so confused by what you just said, which is I thought being advanced was a good thing. And here I was being questioned. My actual identity and age was being questioned because of my abilities. So yeah, that was my first memory.
What do you think the impact? I mean, I was really young. And so there's this sort of emotional, certainly psychological and sociological impact. There's an emotional and spiritual impact too, right? Like what sort of messages did you think, you know, were in the atmosphere for you to receive in that moment as a little girl, right? Because you made that correction. And the only reason I say black woman is because I know black girls are treated to the same rules as if they are women. So you were automatically met with the suspicion of how black women are treated. Oh, they must be trying to scam us.
Yeah.
Right? You weren't treated like a child. You weren't treated like someone to be fed information. You weren't treated like someone who should be guided. You were treated like the exact opposite. You were given the rules of an adult as a child to try and navigate almost day one. So thank you for that correction. But at the end of the day, like, what do you think the impact was you emotionally and spiritually? What were the messages you received in that moment?
Two messages that I really think I held on for a long time. One really great one, which is I really knew my mom was going to show up for me no matter what. I knew that there was not going to be a moment where someone was going to question me, my credentials, my personhood, and that my mom wasn't going to show up, arms raised, ready to fight for me. So that was a really great thing to kind of take in and really have, you know, as a grounding piece. But the other was just a general distrust of the school system and educators, generally speaking, and this notion that I really had to prove myself continually. There's been this thing on Twitter going around like, are you an overachiever or were you labeled a gifted child? You know, something like that. I remember my mom talking to me later, and one of the things she really emphasized was she really did not want me to take the message that I shouldn't show off how smart I was or make myself smaller and all of those kinds of things, because we're Jamaican and we don't do that shit.
But that's right.
It made me really distrustful of adults in the school system. And it put a really specific armor up that in some ways served me really well. But in looking back, hindsight, you know, did not allow me to form bonds with my teachers, especially in elementary school, those first, you know, I would say through third grade, in ways that my peers were able to. And so those were the lasting things. And then, you know, I would say the seeds of my general distrust of white women were definitely planted firmly right there. Firmly.
That's brutal.
Right there. Yeah.
That's brutal, you know, and at the end of the day, it's like dreams deferred, right? I mean, how many opportunities in education did you over the years hesitate to leap into, and how many dreams have been deferred for you, Leslie Mack, because of this one, you know what I mean, interaction, right? Where you're like, you know what, I'm not going to work with an institution. And look, there's reason to have deep mistrust of institutions in general and working with them and bringing any sort of Black thought, Black intellect, or Black innovation to them, right? We see this
and
all
the
time.
And they compound themselves as well. So there's this thing of, there was this one incident, but then let's say a year later, something else happens. And it may not be exactly the same, but I feel the same way. And so they start to kind of stack on top of one another. It's a bit of confirmation bias, but it's also real bias. And so that's the liminal space that Black children sit in. You know, we have to navigate both worlds, and we also are constantly taking in data and then putting it through our filters that we've built for survival and for us to continue to at least try to succeed. And so yeah, it's just an extra burden that our white counterparts don't have to deal with.
Thank you for sharing that. I know no matter how many times we tell a story and no matter how many times we try and share these things, it still brings up stuff. Just even when you just talked about confirmation bias, right? I just ended a relationship with several historical institutions that would have served me long term because it just smelled too much like other things I've experienced, and I just didn't even want to even deal with any of it. Mm-hmm. So I totally can feel that. But what does that look like historically in America? Because that's anecdotal, that story you told, right? I mean, that's what they're going to say, right? That's what people who don't know the experiences of Black people, brown people, queer people, trans people, climate and disaster capitalism refugees, because immigrant is a historical misnomer imposed by the state. The properly used term is a disaster or capitalism refugee. And it fails to address the here and now. So this is a more precise definition of what we're experiencing at the border, right? So we're going to see more and more of this. So we know that public narrative, media, free thought, and certainly the Fourth Estate are all under extreme duress and ready to collapse. We often talk about how in your work you can see the stresses behind the scenes in the system.
Yep.
So how has this historically stereotyping in this way of all kinds of different Black peoples been weaponized in American history? And why does that matter today?
Wow. Where do we start? I was thinking about a few things when putting the notes together for this show. And I guess one of the places I want to start is around this fallacy of the absent Black father, which, you know, has been proven to be statistically wrong despite centuries of U.S. political and cultural policy, from slavery to welfare systems to the war on drugs. You know, these are systems that deliberately destabilize the Black family. And yet, Black fathers show up for their children in higher numbers than their white counterparts when it comes to actual care of their children directly. And I'll quote from a CDC study that says, quote, Black fathers at 70% were more likely to have bathed, dressed, diapered, or helped their children use the toilet every day compared to their white counterparts at 60% and Hispanic fathers at 45%. Also, more Black fathers than white fathers took their children to and from activities every day and helped their children with homework every day. So this is a huge stereotype that we see leveraged politically. We see it leveraged culturally. We see it thrown at Black women and Black men and Black children all of the time.
And Bill Cosby made a whole career off it afterwards.
Listen,
Bill Cosby made a whole career.
The pound cake speech itself, it's awful. So look it up, folks. Look it up. So I start with that one because I think it's one that's so prevalent and that most people just assume is correct because they do, because racism, right? So that's one. I also wanted to talk about the myth around the watermelon.
Oh, man.
You know, that fruit that white racists love to say Black people are in love with eating because we're so lazy and that's all we do. So I'm going to read from The Atlantic because they say it very well here. So the trope about the watermelon and Black people came in full force when enslaved people won their emancipation after the Civil War. Free Black people grew, ate, and sold watermelons, and in doing so, made the fruit a symbol of their freedom. Southern whites, threatened by Black's newfound freedom, responded by making the fruit a symbol of Black people's perceived uncleanliness, laziness, childishness, and unwanted public presence. This racist trope then exploded in American popular culture, becoming so pervasive that its historical origin became completely obscured. And by the 1900s, no one would even know that this was a stereotype that has only been around about 50 years.
And this is all about who controls the levers to media and who controls the narrative and who gets to center their own stories. But please go on.
Well, I'll finish up with the brilliant Moya Bailey's term, misogynoir, which she defines as the anti-Black racist misogyny that Black women experience. It's a very specific descriptor of how Black women have to navigate the world. So many examples exist here. You mentioned one earlier, which is that Black girls are often viewed as older, more mature, or sexually advanced than white girls, which causes allegations that we may bring against assaulters and people that harm us to be taken less seriously. R. Kelly. Well, also, we've been just overtly sexualized, leading to modern day stereotypes as the Jezebel, which you will see in movies, or the mammy, which is the opposite of that particular trope. And so the sexualization of Black women and girls is based in racism, because when European travelers went to Africa, they described women there and continuing throughout slavery. They justified the rape of Black women by claiming that we had insatiable appetites for sex. And so these stereotypes of Black women are based in misogynoir, this combination of racism and misogyny. And so they put Black women into one of four general categories: the sassy Black woman, the angry Black woman, the strong Black woman, or the overtly sexual Black woman. That's it. Those are the four boxes that we have to fit in. And it leaves very little room for individuality, which, frankly, Black women are the most three-dimensional people in the entire world. So it's also an attempt to kind of limit Black women, right? And our ability to assert ourselves, because anytime we express any emotion, we can immediately be dismissed and put in the angry Black woman bucket.
Oh, here we go again. Here we fucking go again. Here fucking Leslie go. God damn it. Bill, did you see this email from Leslie? Did you fucking see this? I can't believe her. We've given her fucking everything. Oh, hi, Leslie. Hi. Yeah, we'll see you in a minute in the conference room. Hi. This fucking bitch.
What more do you want from me is what I hear all the time.
Oh, my God.
Bitch, I want it all. I want it all, bitch. I want all of it. Anyways, just to run down a few things that are related to misogynoir, because it does come in many different forms. Doctors perceive Black women as having higher thresholds for pain, which means we do not get pain treatment when we go in and are in pain in front of people that are supposed to take care of us. We're also viewed as threatening or angry whenever we speak up for ourselves. Our maternal mortality rate is 3 times higher than that of our white counterparts in the United States.
And keeps rising.
Keeps rising. And then finally, the one I wanted to mention was that we find that styles and fashion and things that we do as Black women are deemed unacceptable or ghetto or trashy. But when white women do them, suddenly it's high fashion.
We can't stop. We won't stop talking about this or anything, but... You know what I mean? Like, there's so many white artists who pantomime Black culture, get away with it. Mm-hmm. And then when they're done with it, they throw it off like a costume. Miley Cyrus. And like so many others, right, who can't stop, won't stop, leave our fucking culture alone.
But also, the one thing I wanted to point out, though, is... You know, there's been this conversation about hair bonnets recently. I don't know if anybody's heard, but a hair bonnet is a head covering that Black women wear to keep our curls and our coils intact while we sleep. And there's been this cultural conversation. It started off intracultural, I would say, internal conversation amongst Black folks about where it's acceptable to wear your bonnet and where it's not. I'm of the opinion that Black women can wear whatever the fuck they want to wear, wherever they are. And definitely on a goddamn Zoom, I can wear a bonnet. But I have a prediction.
What is your prediction?
My prediction is that by 2023, we will see bonnets on the high fashion runways of New York and Paris. It will be deemed groundbreaking. So, yeah, that's my prediction.
I know every time I'm presented with particularly the existential threat that Black women are under every day in this country, I hope I wake up a better person, and I hope that happens to our listeners as they kind of wrestle with this information. But we do have some bills to pay and maybe help the People's Response Act while we're at it, and then come back for our summer tour final recap. Our what the fuck is even happening on fall tour report, or is fall tour even happening feeling, and our guest for Fish's costume this Halloween or possibly 2023 or longer, because you won't stay in your fucking house. All that and more when Blackberry Jams, brought to you by Ben and Jerry's and produced by the fine folks at PRX, comes right back.
Hey, Black fans, this message is just for you from Lenny and myself. We want to give you a special invitation to call our 888 Fan Jam, that's 888-PHANJAM phone line, to give us some really specific information about your experience with the band. Lenny, tell them what we're looking for.
We're just looking for you to call in 2 minutes or less. Before episode 9, to tell us about what the perfect show for you would look like. It could be the perfect show for you as a Black fan, the perfect show for you just as a fan, but if the band listened to everything you said and made the entire experience the way you wanted it, what would it look like?
Don't limit yourself to just the music. Think about the venue, think about the vibes, think about the atmosphere. What would make it the most welcoming place for you to be? We want to hear from you. Once again, give us a call, 888-FAN-JAM, that's 888-PHANJAM, and we might include your favorite thing on the show.
Y'all the best.
And welcome back to Blackberry Jams, presented by Ben and Jerry's. What are we talking about next? Are we going to get to actually talk about Fish this show, or?
I fucking hope so, man. I fucking hope so. I just want to talk about music. I get so awkward talking about that shit. Ugh.
I went to see Tab this weekend. We're taping today, Thursday, September 30th, and I've just come back from seeing a slightly downsized version of the Trey Anastasio Band here in Charlotte.
Yo, that was my first question. My first question was, how much of Tab did you see, Leslie?
Well, you know, Jennifer Hartswig tested positive for COVID just before the Charlotte show, and so the whole horn section was pulled out of the show. We wish Jennifer a speedy recovery. And then just a few nights later, drummer Russ Lawton also tested positive, which meant that Trey played a literal solo acoustic show in Columbus. It's interesting because the encore here in Charlotte was him acoustic, just him and the guitar. And so he did an entire show of that, which I might find interesting, but also a little disappointing if you bought a ticket to see the Trey Anastasio Band, especially because the early shows, I mean, people were just raving about how amazing and tight the band was and how great it was. And I had a great time. We had a great time at the show.
I had so much FOMO. I had so much
FOMO. It was such
a
great show. And they just announced yesterday that Don Fishman is going to be joining Tab for the final run of the tour. And then, of course, Fall Fish Tour kicks off in just a few weeks, including their shows at the Maya Riviera, the Halloween run in Vegas. And so they just announced also that the New Year's Eve run will be at MSG once again. But here's my question, like, truly, what are the odds that all four of the boys make it onto this fall tour? I mean, the entire Tab band and crew was fully vaccinated. They're playing outdoor venues that are requiring vaccination cards or negative COVID testing. And here in Charlotte, they even did rapid testing on site. So is there a way to tour safely in the United States right now?
Let's be clear about this cottage industry that's popped up outside of fucking venues, these fucking rapid testing sites. These people are giving free passes to fuckers who don't care about how their personal liberties affect the rest of us. Yeah, fuck you and your cottage industry out front too, all right? I can understand if someone was vaccinated, but what they were doing at different venues, they're splitting the difference at, different venues. So I would say there is a way to tour the U.S. safely, and your road is the West Coast. You're doing a lot of California shows. You're doing a lot of shows in Washington. You're doing shows where at least the bare minimum, the law is you cannot come to a public outdoor venue unless you're vaccinated. Now, Washington let them do that testing out front at the Gorge, I think. So like maybe Washington's out, but Oregon's not going for that shit. Kate Brown's not going for that shit. I mean, she got her ass kicked in the polls and Newsom just fucking fought off a fucking runoff election. So he's going to double down on that shit. And, you know, when I went to go see Bobby Leslie, like I told you, they scanned my face through my Clear app. You couldn't just bring your vaccination card. Like, you had to prove that you really were the person who that vaccination card belongs to by uploading it with your ID into the fucking Clear system. That's how California's fucking rolling, right? And so I think by the time you get to LA and other places, you're going to see a lot more restrictions. And I think that'll keep the band safe. Now, you didn't ask me, is there a way to tour safely in the US right now for other people? We were very band specific. I think the community impact is yet to be really measured. I want to be clear. I'm not saying that I think it's worse or really bad because, you know, I went out from the very beginning of the pandemic and, you know, I went right down to the Justice Center, right? In Portland and we fucking didn't stop. And we did our own testing and, you know, we had Doctors for Black Lives and Nurses for Black Lives. That was the names of the organizations, right? And these were doctors in the middle of the fucking pandemic and nurses in the middle of the pandemic who took their one day off a week and came down and volunteered for us. So these fucking folks are dope. And, you know, they did the studies, right? They were studying several things at the time. They were studying what was really the chemical that the PPB and the federal government used against us, which we still don't know, right? It wasn't tear gas. We know it certainly is not part of the Geneva Convention. You know, you can't use tear gas against an enemy combatant in a theater of war, but we use it on our own citizens. I digress. And we tested everyone to the best of our ability, anyone who was there on a regular basis, and our numbers were lower than people who went to fucking Costco. We were masked, we were outdoors, we were keeping distances, but there were times we were marching in very tight fucking clusters for long periods of time. And I got to tell you, our numbers were incredibly low. That was before the Delta variant. I don't know what the community impact is. What are we doing to these communities we're going to, which is more what I'm worried about. I don't want... You know what I mean? Someone flying in from fucking Nebraska where they don't give a fuck just to see fish and spreading, like, you know what I mean? The fucking mutant Omega variant in some fucking black neighborhood where the fucking venue is.
That's definitely the question I have, too, is like, you know, you're mentioning this cottage industry. You're mentioning vaccinations, although we are seeing breakthrough cases. Obviously, both Jennifer and Russ are breakthrough cases because they were fully vaccinated. And as I said, Tab's band members and their entire crew are vaccinated. So they really are taking as many precautions as possible, including outdoor venues and, you know, requiring testing or vaccination to attend. But is it enough? Would on-site rapid testing for everybody attending be better? Plus vaccination. I took a picture at the show and it was a picture of a balloon and I posted on Instagram and I said, Drew asked me, oh, what do you think's in that balloon? And I said, definitely COVID. Because COVID. I can't
COVID. Why'd
help
you blow
but
a balloon?
See.
Stop blowing balloons.
And it made it onto the stage. Like Trey had to kick it off the stage. And this isn't saying anything. It's more about the fact that the nature of live music is that there's an exchange between the audience and the performer, right? That's the entire reason we go do it instead of just putting our headphones on.
Right.
And so
exactly.
I'm trying to wrap my mind around in the midst of a pandemic that is not getting better across this country. What does it mean for a full capacity Madison Square Garden for New Year's Eve. It feels reckless as numbers are rising, and especially to bring to a city like New York City that is still reeling from the incalculable losses from COVID. Should they have skipped New Year's Eve this year?
A governor who hid the bodies. No one cared about that because, you know, human loss of poor people and people we don't know. It's hard for us to wrap our heads around until it's like grandma. And New York is going to pay for a lot of people making these decisions in capitalism. But we talk about fish. But really, are we going to blame fish because New York City opened up fucking entertainment now? That's a New York City thing. I mean, I got to be honest with you. There are places that are fucking
yes,
like, fuck you, don't come here.
And yes, and just because you can do something doesn't mean you should.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. I mean, that is the question at the heart of what's been happening since the attempted coup on January 6th. What does it mean to have individual liberty? And how do you weigh that against the cost of the community impact? Because that's what freedom means. Freedom means that, like, I know that I have individual liberty and I can do almost anything I want, but there are certain things that we have agreed upon as a society that we will not do in the name of keeping most of us safe. And are most of those white and heteronormative? Yes. But you look at the Spanish flu, you look at World War II, you look at the reaction after 9/11, you look at when we first cared about children being shot in schools. You remember that like 10 years ago when it was shocking? Yeah. See, we come together at those times, but we're not seeing that now. What we're seeing is individual liberty and freedom kind of being weaponized against the rest of the nation and entertainment. Sports. I mean, the NFL is going on like it's full fucking steam. They don't give a fuck. We're all kind of caught in this fucking capitalist undertow. And I do think we all play a fucking part. And I do think we all have a responsibility.
We do. I mean, I'm getting on a plane. I'm flying out to Oregon to come and see these shows with you because I really want to. And I want to see the boys at least once this year. It is a decision I'm making with some trepidation, some fear. Definitely a lot of privilege, and also this balance that we've had to all contend with in the midst of COVID, which is self-care and the greater good. Because for me, being able to go to the shows, being able to come out and see you, like, it's going to feed me. It's going to feed me emotionally. It's going to feed me spiritually. It's going to feed me, you know, fill up my joy tank. And I need that right now. But as you're saying, there is a price to be paid for that. And I think that all, not just this jam band scene, but concerts generally speaking, music generally speaking. And I know that these artists really want to be able to get back out on the road. And a lot of it is not only about capitalism. I went to see Robert Glasper a couple of weeks ago in DC. And he just remarked, he's like, playing for a virtual audience is weird and I don't like it. And I miss this. I miss seeing your faces. I miss us going back and forth. I mean, it was a great show. We all broke out into singing Pretty Brown Eyes a cappella at one point. I mean,
oh, so amazing.
You can't get that from a screen. And so I think that for the artists, and especially for a band like Fish and a jam band generally speaking, where the magic is in the live performance, taking this away, it's taking away not just their livelihood, but their lifeline. And I really understand that.
I know exactly what you're saying. And the fear of losing that, the fear of losing that thing that gives you life and breath and sweet, sweet rivers you can dunk yourself in that are so life-giving. I'm looking forward to actually hanging with you and going to see Fish so fucking bad this year, right? But there's just like bigger issues around it. Even though that could be so life-giving, it's like, how do I weigh? And this has been my entire question, the pandemic. When does my mental health and my emotional health outweigh the risk to others and the risk to myself by going to do something that's life-giving? And I've asked myself that question over and over again. And it's been hard to figure out a yes or a no.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I just don't know.
I don't think we will know. You mentioned like the new normal or as the world is today before. I think that's the continual anxiety-inducing reality that we are all having to navigate about almost every decision. Do we pick up our groceries? Do we go into the store? Do we go out to dinner? Do we have it delivered? Do we cook ourselves? Do we leave our packages outside for a period of time? Do we go to a concert? You know, all of those things. Do we see our family? How do we see our family? All of those things, you know, that heretofore have been fairly mundane in terms of a decision-making process now have this added component. And I think it's important that people talk about it. It's really detrimental to our mental health and psyches to not acknowledge the difficulties of making decisions right now. I know I found myself very paralyzed in recent weeks, just kind of like stuck. I don't know which way to go. One, I'm not used to feeling that way. I'm an incredibly decisive person. But also that takes a toll on you mentally. We're adding another layer of decision-making processes on top of the ones we already have to make. And the world is on fire. So I just want to say I'm happy that we were able to talk about that in the context of our desire to go and see these amazing musicians and be part of this scene that we love and we're excited. And look, we're trying. Lenny and I are going to go to the shows in Eugene. And if they happen, we're going to be there and we'll report back and let you know how they went. But just know we didn't arrive at this easily. And we had a lot of conversations among ourselves up to the point of like purchasing our tickets, which was not
live
that long
FaceTime
ago.
FaceTime tours
literally
of my community.
All of the things. So I could see where I'd be and all, you know, it took a lot. It took a
and
lot.
Make sure
and so
it'd
I
be
just
safe
want to acknowledge
that you'd have
that.
Space. Yeah. No, 100%. I mean, no, 100%. And thank you for, you know, helping me tease some of that out. Cause I've been really struggling with some of these decisions, you know, and it is a hard time. You know, I left the church because I was so decision weary. As a faith leader who was trying to do liberatory work and, you know, was queer and was trying to create safe space for queer people after the uprisings and everything that had happened. And then we had wildfires here that we ran relief for and all kinds of shit that I was like, you know, just, I just kept going. I was so decision weary. By the time we started recording this podcast, I couldn't do anything else. You know what I mean? So, you know, thank you for helping frame some of that. I want to move to something a little bit more pie in the sky. If Fish Halloween happens, what will be their costume? What is your prediction? Leslie Mack, put it on the record.
Okay, so this may sound a little left field-ish, but I'm going to call Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys because I feel like the boys coming out with like Hawaiian shirts and I don't know. I just think it would be a cool vibe. Plus, it's super hot in Vegas and I think it would make a good costume. And to hear them, their take on Pet Sounds would be amazing. So
oh my God. That's
going to be my prediction.
Oh, my fucking God. That is a great prediction. That's so fucking good. Well, mine is that Trey is going to talk them into doing Ozzy Osbourne finally. And here's why. If they do the Ozzy Osbourne band, not only do they get to bite a bat head and all that dumb shit, right? Not only do they get to wear really cool costumes and like, you know, Mike can be his fucking emo self. But more importantly, you can get a little bit of fucking Black Sabbath. And you can get a little bit of Ozzy Osbourne out of it too, right? So like imagine like Trey jamming out to like Perry Mason, like a 15-minute jam to Perry Mason, or like a super soulful like Paige Mama I'm Coming Home. Oh my God, dude.
Oh, that would be really beautiful.
Like I just think there's like so much good music that Ozzy put together, but he really didn't have the capacity to make, you know, take out for a spin that the boys would have fun with. And then they could do like some hard rocking like fucking Sabbath shit at the end and make people lose their shit and all that. So I think it's going to be Ozzy Osbourne band this year.
I love that suggestion, especially because we were just talking about how into metal Trey was before when the band started. And
exactly
that, and your general love of Evil Fish. So I appreciate that.
It would feel Halloween. We could wear like fucking real, like fucking scary shit. It'd be fun.
Well, we'll see if it happens and what happens. We'll see both. that is it for this episode of Blackberry Jams. Our production team includes the incredible Jocelyn Gonzalez, the maestro himself, Pedro Rafael Rosado, and also Ian Fox and Jason Saldana from PRX Productions.
And we're brought to you with the support of the fine folks over at Ben and Jerry.
You can check us out on socials at Blackberry Fans. That's PHANS. And you can catch me on Twitter at Leslie Mack, MAC. And Lenny, where can folks find you?
Well, I am Lenny A. Duncan everywhere on every platform. Please add me.
Remember to subscribe and leave us a review in your favorite podcast app and tell a friend about the show. It really helps us out. I'm Leslie.
I'm Lenny.
And this is Blackberry Jams, presented to you by Ben and Jerry's.